The world-famous Conservation Canine Camp will next be running in southeast Queensland, Australia, from the 21st to the 25th of August. Join us with your dog to start your journey into conservation detection. Visit padfoot.com.au to book your place today. Welcome to the Conservation Canine Podcast, the show that celebrates the dog teams protecting the natural world. I'm James Davis, and in this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Nathan Hall. Nathan is director of the Canine Olfaction Lab at Texas Tech. We talk about your dog's olfactory ability, the importance of keeping and using appropriate training aids, and how to reduce the risk of false indication. Okay, Nathan, welcome to the Conservation Canine Podcast. So, as an olfaction geek, like every good detection dog trainer, I've been really looking forward to our chat. So, to start, for those who don't know you, can we perhaps start with a bit of background and what you're working on at the moment?
Yes. So, my background is I did a PhD in experimental psychology and behavior analysis. And through that, I got interested in the dog's sense of smell. Largely because I've always been interested in things that I could not see, feel, but knew kind of existed. So, and also trying to understand the perspective and perception of the animals around us, and who better to study than our dogs, and what better to study if we want to understand what their world is like is their sense of smell. And then the first thing you do is you sort of dig down into the scientific literature because that's just how you typically start off, assuming that there would be so much known about the dog's sense of smell, only to be finding out is that we almost know nothing. And it was quite shocking, in the sense that we've got dogs everywhere doing incredible things, but we have so little of it actually documented and so little of it understood, which I wasn't sure whether that felt, comforting and that I was like, wow, I've got a lot to do, or kind of just, now what? What do we look at first? Kind of perspective. So I did my PhD in 2015, did a postdoc in 2016. And then since then, I've been here at Texas Tech University for what will soon to be 6 years, studying dog sense of smell in a variety of different kinds of contexts. Mostly what we're interested in is looking at how does learning and experience influence our sensory systems. So one of the things that at least was my default is that I tend to think of my vision or my hearing or even my sense of smell are these kinds of static phenomenon. They just are what they are, and I'm perceiving the world around me as it is, obviously to the best of my sensory system, but that's just what it is. I'm seeing the real world. But in reality, in psychology, what we learn is that all of that is clouded through our experiences. And I guess clouded is even the wrong word. It's enhanced and sort of targeted based off of our learning and experience. So there's a great textbook essentially out there. It's called Learning to Smell. And that really is the best sort of descriptor of it. We learn to see, we learn to smell, we learn to hear. What we perceive in and around us is actually a very strongly kind of learned phenomenon. Think about when you're listening to a TV that's in a different foreign language. It's very hard to even pick out, words, even if you're vaguely familiar. So, I started learning Spanish at, 12, 14, right? And I can, ask where's the bathroom and a few embarrassing things like that. But when you watch it on TV, it's even hard to just pick out those words. Is that because I have a deficit in my sensory systems? No, I have a deficit in my learning system. It's a completely learned thing. And our sense of smell is the exact same way. And then trying to think about it is that our dog is like, learning of what they need to experience and what they're looking for and how that changes their sensory system is what has been the focus of our research for about the last 6 years. Sorry, that was a really long answer to a very simple question.
No, that was great. That was a great sort of introduction to the work that you do. And tell us a little bit about your lab. So how is it set up? You know, who have you got working there? That kind of thing. Who's doing what?
Yeah, so we've got essentially the lab is ours. So it's just kind of me as the driver of it. But in reality, I always say my lab, I'm the least important person. In fact, it's driven on a day-to-day basis by a team of about 18 undergraduate students right now, 2 graduate students, and then 2 postdocs. They are the lifeblood and what drives the day-to-day operations. And I just sort of, guide the ship here and there, and make sure everything is working out well. So we have postdocs that are working on a couple of different projects and graduate students working on a couple of different projects. Sort of the bread and butter of what our program is that we run some basic dog training courses for our students here at the university. And we run a train to adopt program through that. So we actually have dogs. We partner with a bunch of rescue organizations dogs enter into our program, and they learn simple things like walking loosely on a harness, sit, down, stay, going to bed, and just sort of being able to hang out and, you know, sit nicely next to you and get some love from people. And those kinds of simple skills, and our students work with them throughout a semester to build those in the dogs, while at the same time they participate in our detection training. So then we train them essentially from scratch to whatever detection task that we're looking at. And we've set up some automated systems that actually help us sort of present all of the odors, time, and measure all of their responses. And then essentially do our different training experiences or different training protocols and look at what effect does that have on overall performance for them.
Yeah, that's great. And out of your sort of your grad students and your postdocs working there at the moment, is anybody working on anything really cool that you're able to share?
Yeah, well,
the rub is, are you able to share?
Yeah, they're all working on super cool things. So I can probably should have had more preparation of very specific things, but I can talk about a couple of the things that our students have been working on. One is 2 things that have recently are going out for publication now, so you'll actually be able to follow up with them soon. One is looking at how the impact of the concentration at which we train our dogs influences their detection limits. So a lot of people have talked about, and it's been sort of anecdotally reported for a while, that if you train dogs at one particular concentration, they'll essentially walk lower concentrations or higher concentrations. We were particularly interested and focused on the idea of lower concentrations, especially in situations where there might be concealment or very low vapor pressure. So there might be low concentrations of odors. And this is an experiment. Essentially, what we did is that we split the dogs off into 2 groups. One group essentially was always trained at the same concentration of target material. So they would get training daily on that. And then every so often we would measure their detection thresholds to that target. And how we do that is we call it 2 down, 1 up staircase procedure. So if they get 2 right, we decrease the concentration of it. They get 2 right, we decrease the concentration. They get 2 right, we decrease the concentration. They get 1 wrong, we go back up in concentration. They get 1 wrong, we go back up in concentration. And essentially what ends up happening is that the dog starts bouncing around at a certain range of concentrations. They go lower, they can't get it. They go up, they can get it. They go lower, they can't get it. They go up, they can get it. And then essentially you find what we call through a series of reversals that concentration that they seem to be able to detect versus the concentration that they can. So there's some training that's inherent within this procedure at lower concentrations. And we were curious but what this does get at is, what is the minimum that you still say is the target odor? And we compared that to an experimental group of dogs that had the same amount of training as control. We yoked them, as what we'd say experimentally, but we didn't actually tie them together. We just tied together the amount of training that they had to a group that had the same amount of training, but instead of training them always to the same concentration of target material, we trained them to the same starting concentration and then lowered that by twofold or two times. So we lowered it one time, trained them on that, lowered it again, trained them on that. And what we saw is that our experimental dogs ended up having about a 100-fold improvement in their detection limits compared to our control dogs, and that they showed a significant improvement from the beginning of their training to the end of their training. Whereas our control dogs, they were still excellent at the same target material, but when it came to lower concentrations, their performance was not as good and they were not as sensitive. And because of the random assignment at the beginning, it's unlikely that there were initial differences in the dogs. This is probably just due to, and at the first, training step, they were actually identical. So there was no differences between the two groups. So it seems to indicate that what you can smell is largely related to what you've been trained to smell, which ties into another study that recently sort of come out, is looking at generalization across different odor concentrations. So we were looking at a target material and an air dilution olfactometer that allows us to change the concentration of that odor, and looking at what are the concentrations that dogs will, in an untrained setting, spontaneously alert to. So in the previous one, the dogs were essentially getting reinforced for hitting on lower concentrations. So there was kind of training that was inherent within that procedure. And they would typically hit on or eventually learn to hit about a 100-fold, within 100-fold of that initial training concentration. So if you could detect a 100% target material, you could, in the initial study, the dogs could then be trained to detect a 1% target material. What we were interested in is, if you were trained specifically at 100% target material, if you were just one day walking around and given a different target material, say 10%, 5%, 40%, and you weren't getting reinforced one way or the other because nobody knows whether it's really there or not, what range of target material will you generalize to? And the answer to that was 10%. So spontaneously, the dogs typically generalize to within a 10% lower concentration to what they were initially trained on. And then what we were interested in is, could we actually, are there situations, and we were interested in a particular situation related to oil, but there are other situations where maybe you want them to only detect concentrations that are higher than X, or so if it's lower than this value, don't alert to it. If it's higher than this value, go ahead and alert to it. And can you actually train that concentration discrimination? And the answer was yes. Dogs actually very quickly picked up on sort of a discrimination between concentrations. What we did is after we sort of fit that initial generalization gradient, we picked a concentration that they did spontaneously alert to, which was about a 20% dilution of the initial training material. And they would show confusion between that. So they would occasionally alert to the 20% material. So then we use that as a reference. No, don't alert to this under extinction, and then reinforce just the high concentration. And within about 6 days, they were showing greater than 90% accuracy in discriminating between only the high concentration odorant and ignoring the low concentration odorant of the exact same odor. So that turned out not to be a problem. Interestingly, though, when we redid their generalization assessment, they essentially went back to square one. They stopped. They started alerting to that 20% concentration again, and they stopped alerting to, well, they never were alerting to, but they were alerting to that 20% concentration again, but also alerting to the higher concentrations like before. So we're like, well, what's going on there? That's kind of interesting that once we sort of removed that away, they sort of went back to where they were before. So we added sort of a final training procedure, which was a compound procedure, where essentially we measured their generalization to a range of concentrations while also constantly training them on respond to this concentration, don't respond to that concentration. And when we did that, we did get exactly what we saw. They would only generalize to, they would only respond to the higher concentrations. Their generalization was much narrower to only concentrations that were higher than something, higher than what we told them not to. So it produced what we would call like a peak shift. They started to respond only to the really strong odors, and anything lower, they stopped responding to. So we were able to see that discrimination. But it was interesting in that it needed to be sort of compounded at the same time. And what this indicated to us, or what my working hypothesis of that, is that a lot of our sort of perception is what I call relative stimulus control. It's not the dogs are trained to find exactly this concentration, but sometimes it can also be, I want to find under these contexts, things greater than that. I don't want to find that. I want to find things greater than this, or I want to find things less than that. And they can be quite sensitive to those kinds of things. So if we tell them, I don't want you to alert to this low concentration, and I want you to only alert to high things, that they will respond to, I'll only alert to super strong odors and not to these lower concentration odors, which highlights the importance of cleanliness in our training. Because if you think, if you accidentally contaminate a clean sample and you're training your dog not to alert to that, that's exactly the compound discrimination that we just found, is that, you know, you might be running the dog on what you think is a clean sample, but it's actually an incidentally contaminated sample. And essentially what you're training your dog is, don't alert to anything lower than this, or only alert to things that smell stronger than that. So you might end up incidentally sort of shortfalling their detection limits when you have sort of a dirty kind of system or cross-contamination. That was really long-winded. Did that even make any sense?
Yeah, no, it didn't. It's absolutely fascinating. It's really interesting to me how, I mean, you can get the chemical composition of a scent, but then when you overlay that kind of psychological element on behalf of the dog, you know, how much they've been trained on that scent, maybe even they've got some sort of inherent sensitivity psychologically to a particular scent or something like that. Have you guys done any work around that? Are there any particular scents or anything like that the dogs are just naturally more sensitive to?
Yeah, that's a great question. So there is not a lot of great work on there, but there is some evidence that I think that that's probably likely totally true. So we know in humans that there are some scents we are incredibly sensitive to. So one of them is vanilla. We absolutely are super sensitive to vanilla. We have, out of things, we have super low detection thresholds for that. We also have quite good detection thresholds for that smelly chemical they add to gas lines. We can detect that in really low concentrations. But there's an entire sort of natural evolution that we need to, that we can consider, because we have different olfactory receptors. Those olfactory receptors are coded through our DNA, which are related obviously through and controlled through natural selection. So it's quite likely that there's definitely differences in the type of odors that are going to be inherently more sensitive. When we look at detection thresholds between dogs and humans, you've probably heard before that, you know, dogs are 10,000 times more sensitive than our humans. And that's true for one odor that we know of, but it's not true for a variety of odors. And actually, there are odors in which humans are more sensitive than dogs are, according to the scientific literature. So it's not this kind of uniform thing. And in fact, it's actually more interesting and nuanced than that. So the detection thresholds for acetic acid are actually quite similar between a human and a dog. So if you ever needed a vinegar detection dog, you'd probably do better having a vinegar detection human than you would having a vinegar detection dog, or it'd be about the same. And then there are actually odors where the human is more sensitive to different types of acids. So that definitely means that it's not uniform, and then there's going to be super differences in the dog's detection threshold for certain chemicals over others. No one's really done a broad scale detection threshold measurement of the dogs. We have pretty much, I think it's about up to 8 or 10 different odors right now. But in humans, there's essentially a book that, you know, tells us our detection thresholds for a wide variety of different odorants. But we don't have that for the dog, which is actually kind of interesting because you'd think that we would want to know those kinds of things. What are they uniquely sensitive to? And perhaps if we were clever, we might be thinking about looking at it in other species. What are other species uniquely sensitive to? Because perhaps based off their biological evolution, there might be some species where this target material would make them the best detection animal for that versus this animal. And then we bring in the whole question of breed, which again, we still don't even know, but there's quite logically going to be differences within that, not perhaps related to the shape, related to the nose. But there also could be evolutionary histories in terms of the breeding that might lead to different sort of genetics when it comes to the olfactory receptor repertoire. So that makes it all the more interesting, you know, as in what can they smell? What can they not smell? What are they better at? What are they not? My anecdotal evidence is totally just by randomly playing with different odors, and it's by no means scientific. It seems that floral odors, humans and dogs, in my experience, whenever we tested floral odors with the dogs, their detection limits would essentially drop off at nearly the same as mine were. There was not much different. But when it came to different kinds of food odors, like the amyl acetate, they were detecting it well beyond anything that I could find. But things like rose smells, that tended to drop off just about the same rate as mine. Totally making that. I don't know if that's true or not, or if that's a general finding. But there's good reason. We definitely know that there's definitely differences between different odors. And there's probably good reason to believe that there could be a wide gamut of what they're good at and what they're less good at.
Yeah, and that makes a lot of sense, right? You know, because from an evolutionary perspective or whatever, you know, if what interest have they got in smelling a rose to a certain extent? You know, that they're looking for their prey, or they're looking for something to scavenge, or, you know, whatever. So they may not have developed, you know, that ability to the same degree, you know, just because it's unnecessary for them. But an interesting thing that what you're talking about raises is, how much of it is the actual training to use the nose? So we as humans don't really use our noses. We don't use our olfactory ability that much. So if you put out that vinegar smell, for example, you know, where we've got the two, you know, where we're on a sort of an even keel, mm-hmm. and you say you put it out in an experiment and it was going, you know, so use your nose to find this, yeah, wherever it is. Presumably the dog would be better at finding it simply because their noses are muscles that are more practiced than ours are. So even though their detectability ratio or whatever is the same, they would still find it quicker than we would, or not. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I would say the dog would find it quicker. One is that they can run faster than me, but two, they also have other benefits on board that we're not good at, that I think makes a big difference, especially when it comes to like deployability. So when you're looking when you're controlling the odor, the actual detection limits may be kind of similar, but where the dog is particularly good at are things that we know improve olfactory detection that we just don't do because we don't care to do it. So one is sniffing. Just don't sniff. We don't very, very infrequently will we sniff. And sniffing is actually something that's probably perhaps behaviorally an incredibly important thing. We actually did, going back to breed, a study a little while ago. And it was comparing German Shepherds and pugs and greyhounds on a simple odor detection discrimination test. And the spoiler alert was that the pugs actually did fantastic and beat out the German Shepherds on the detection task. And one of the things that it seemed to be is that it was perhaps of behavioral differences. The pugs were sniffing hard. They were going through, I mean, there is, you know, occlusion of the nares in some of the pugs, but they were specifically behaviorally sniffing, whereas they seemed to be doing it significantly more than what the other dogs were. So perhaps, you know, behaviorally you can accommodate for a lot of those things. So one of the big differences between us and the dog is also the frequency at which we sniff. So when we sniff or we're taking in air, we're typically doing it at about 0.5 hertz or once every 2 seconds. Whereas our dog is doing it at 5 to 6 hertz per second when they're actually doing something interesting. So that, you know, you go and that sort of very active sniffing. So try doing it yourself 6 times in 1 second. It physically hurts. We actually have a device where we measured it so I can like do it myself and you nearly pass out. It's very, very difficult to do that. And the dog can actually sustain this. And one of the things that we think why that's particularly important is a phenomenon called change blindness. So if you remember perhaps when you were a kid, 2 different pictures and or they're basically the same picture and there are minor differences between them and you have to look between the 2 pictures and spot the 5 differences between them. And so that was a lot of fun and we tend to be able to do them pretty well. And the way that we do that is you're not realizing it because you're used to your eyes moving very, very quickly, but your eyes are moving back and forth very, very rapidly. That's shifting your attention between the two, allowing you to make very quick comparisons. If I were to simply take one of those pictures and put it on a separate page so that you had to flip pages between them, that would become significantly more difficult. So then you can think about the dog at 5 to 6 hertz, right? Going, they're essentially doing the eye moving up and down, comparing the 2 pictures. They can compare to something within a fraction of a second ago to another sample. Whereas with us, we're comparing from one sample we took now to a sample we're going to take in 2 seconds from now. So minor differences are going to be very hard to detect because we'd have to keep that in our working memory, exactly what something smelled like 2 seconds ago, whereas the dog has got that within a fraction of a second. So it makes it a lot easier to make minor comparisons in sort of concentration, which would be necessary for something like tracking. So that's definitely a really big component to it. A second is that, especially when it comes to doing search or a lot of the tasks that we have them, it's just unusual for us to get down on our hands and knees and sniff things or to sniff bags. It sounds silly, but that actually is a potentially dramatic difference is that we just don't do it behaviorally. So there's definitely a learning component to it, but there's also just, we don't even put ourselves in the right position to do it. There was a study back in 2007 that actually made people do it. They paid undergraduates to get on their hands and knees and follow a trail of essential oils of chocolate. So they had to get down and sniff it, and they could do it. And they ran dogs through a similar track, and they actually followed a similar kind of trail that the dogs did. So it's not that it's beyond our capabilities. It's just that we have some disadvantages. Some of them are self-imposed that we just won't get down and sniff things. But then a lot of them are going to be this behaviorally sniffing imposed that we just physically can't do it, as well as differences within our detection limits that we've previously talked about.
Yeah, it's just socially unacceptable, isn't it, at the moment? You know, nobody really thanks you for running around sniffing them or sniffing things. Yep. you get a few funny looks, I'd say.
Yeah, I had a project that we started doing, but ended up abandoning just because it was too much trouble and too weird. But it was just looking at what do interesting things that dogs like smell like, essentially just categorizing and following along. So whenever a dog would stop and sniff for a few seconds, I'd collect a sample of it and sniff it. Yeah, that was kind of weird. And then people didn't want to do it because then it tended to be gross things. And so anyway, we never really got far with that. But I think there's definitely a social thing. Like, I mean, if you were to see an owner walking their dog stops to sniff at something and they bend down and do it and also sniff it, which is something I have done before. I'll admit I am a weirdo like that. It's just something that we don't do.
Yeah, but I think it probably happens more regularly in the conservation dog world than any other. Probably, you know, if I'm out there looking for something in my dogs and they sniff a tree or something like that, I'll quite often have a bit of a sniff myself just to.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah.
Yeah, just to see if it's, you know, like a urine-y smell or if they're just another random, you know, something interesting.
Yeah, oh, totally. I appreciate that, because I always thought I was the weird one, so I'm actually in good company.
Yeah, absolutely. There's lots and lots of weirdos in the conservation dog world, definitely. So moving on to that. So training dogs for conservation detection is extremely complicated. So just due to the sheer range of environmental and other factors that often get in our way. So these can range from the scale of the search areas through to the crypsis of our targets, to the legal controls that often prohibit our ability to capture that precise target scent, that you want for training purposes. Like if you're dealing with endangered animals or anything like that, there's a lot of loopholes you got to do, a lot of things you got to jump through, before you're able to train on that properly. So what I'd really like to ask you, how do you think we can design our training in the conservation dog world to best optimize our dog's detection abilities?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't envy your guys' job in that sense. I'm lucky in the sense that I just have to produce research, not real results in that sense. So you've got a lot of real life challenges that you have to face in that sense. But if I'd have to say that there's like one kind of golden rule that we've found so far, or one kind of general theme that it seems to be that kind of has picked up on, or at least is underlying a lot of the different studies, is that you've got to train the dog to what you want them to find, and not some in between or something around that. There are definitely ways in which you can do certain things, but if you want them to find only a high concentration, then you train them on a high concentration. That's what they'll find. A lot of times, we try to make certain kinds of changes of the target material for a variety of different reasons. But it seems that they will find what you train them to find. And that also tends to be true sort of in the, trick way, because dogs are beautiful cheaters. I love them for it. But they are absolutely fantastic cheaters, because from their perspective, they don't view it as cheating. They just view it as a clever way that they've solved the game. And if they can solve the game faster and easier than using their nose and working harder, then they will. And that's something that we play with all of the time, is figuring out how dogs are cheating one way or another, or picking up on things that we never even thought of from the get-go, which is related to certain contingencies. So like if they can, for example, one of the experiments that we did a while ago is that we found out that the dogs would learn that if they just simply randomly pick something doesn't matter which one, if I just pick something, then that trial will time out, which will get me to a new trial, which is an easier trial and more likely to be successful. And that would be faster than actually trying hard. So I could try hard and get both correct, or I could just randomly pick one, get me to the easy one, and then get my toy or food on the easy one. They're very clever in those kinds of situations. So I don't think that really answers any of the questions, except for the fact that being conscientious of what your training material is and what you're training your dogs to from a task needs to try and match what you want to be operationally. So this would come out for things like if you are planning to search for something that you're probably not going to find for a day, then your training needs to match that condition, that there are actual training days in which your dog may not find anything for a day. Or if you're going to find one thing for a day, then your training condition should match that. If you're training, I love sort of an experimental setup where you can control things, and that's definitely great to do. But you also need to make sure that your training is happening in the environments in which you're working in as well. Because it may not spontaneously generalize from one setting to another. It will definitely generalize to some degree, but it may not completely in the same way. So like if your dog is performing 100% in this training scenario, that doesn't necessarily mean it will perform 100% in a different field or in a different environment without having that training to help them sort of transition from one environment to the next.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, it's a problem that I've experienced myself. It's a mistake I've made myself in the past. I'm looking for invasive species dens. You don't get that many wins. You know, you may search a very large area over the course of a day with two wins for the dog. Mm-hmm. In the training shed before that, so obviously what you're doing is you're getting them, you know, onto the scent as much as you can, and you're working in that environmental context. But I'd never really thought about that duration of the search until I had a dog that had previously had another job. So prior to that, he was a hunting shooting dog. Mm-hmm. And I would find with him that after a few hours of searching, he'd actually start to veer off and revert back to his former job a bit. He's obviously looking, for the win. The desperation's got there. So back to the training shed, obviously much bigger, more challenging hides, you know, building up that duration, a lot more emphasis on building up that duration of the search for him, to get him back, back on point.
Definitely. It's an interesting thing.
So look, I mean, how many samples do you think we need to train a dog on to teach them to generalize effectively? So if you look at a scat, for an example, obviously you've got, so say you're looking at the same species, but you're looking at, you know, scat from different ages, different animals, different ailments, different ages, different sexes, different ecological contexts, different quantities. You know, if you want them to reliably find scat, koala scat, you know, for example, how many different variables or how many different samples would you need to have used for them to generalize across all koala scats in all contexts, do you think?
Yeah, that's a great question. So here's where the scientist part of me is going to show through. I don't know. Nobody knows. We don't have an answer for it. The working operational answer for right now in the meantime is as many as you can get your hands on. So we do know from animal categorization studies and animal cognition studies, we've been learning about, what we call concept formation since the 1950s. And this was actually research that was done in pigeons. So the initial research of this was, can animals form, and we had these questions of, can animals even form kind of abstract concepts? So in this case would be scat from koala, right? There's not a very simple definition of scat from koala from an olfactory perspective, right? Because it's going to overlap with scat from other animals. It's going to overlap with a variety of other things. There's not a simple defining category that if this chemical is present, it is scat from koala. Maybe there is, but unlikely probably to be the case. It's probably some complex relationship between the chemicals that are there that defines it as being scat from a koala. So the sort of abstract version of this that has been going on from the 50s is, well, can pigeons also form kind of what we call these abstract concepts of something like a tree? If you show them a picture, can they tell you if there's a tree in it? And I think a lot of the CAPTCHA things that now, I had one the other day that was like, click all the pictures that have a traffic light in it. And I was like, my goodness, you know, people have trained pigeons to do this since the 1950s, and now I'm being trained to do it. Because it's something that computers actually have trouble doing it. That's why CAPTCHA does it, is that it's actually quite a challenging cognitive task. But we have learned that pigeons can do it, and they can do it really, really well. So you can show them a picture with bushes, they won't respond to that. You can show them a picture of grass, they won't respond to that. A picture of cars, they won't respond to that. A picture of a small bonsai tree, they'll respond to that, or to a variety of different trees. How do you define that? It's very difficult, right? Because trees are in all different shapes, they're in all different colors. They could be red in fall, they could be green in different environments. But you can train that. And the way that you do that is essentially by giving them one stimulus set, say 10 pictures with trees, 10 pictures without trees. And then you give them another stimulus set, 10 new pictures with trees, 10 new pictures without trees. And then another stimulus set, 10 new pictures with trees, 10 new pictures without trees. And then essentially when the dog or when the animal is officially trained, and how you know if your animal is officially trained, is you get 10 samples, and this will use koala scat. Let's say you get 10 samples of koala scat, 10 samples of other animal scat or other related distractors that would logically be in the environment. give them to your dog, and then measure their first response, not the response after they've already been marked or reinforced, because they can learn it like that. They can learn it in a couple of trials. But when you give them their first response, this is the first time they've seen it. If they have developed that cognitive concept of this is what koala scat smells like, then they should show sufficient performance on these brand new samples the first time you give it to them. So if they get 9 out of 10 on that, they hit 9 of those 10 koala scats and, you know, 1 of the 10 others, then you can say that my dog has sufficiently demonstrated this sort of generalization of a concept, that they understand what the smell of koala scat is versus other things, and they can do this with new samples. One thing that we fail to do a lot of times, and particularly with even some of the cancer detection studies, is that we just have, this is our stimulus set that we train them on, and they eventually learn it. But a lot of times we find that they've actually just memorized the specific identities of those individual samples, so that these 10 samples that you're saying are koala scat versus these 10 samples that are not, they've essentially identified what are the unique characteristics of each one of those 10, but have not made that generalization of what is the general category of koala versus non-koala. And we can do these kinds of generalization things with pigeons all day with very complex things. There was a paper that came out with actually looking at can they be used to identify cancerous cells in slides, biopsy slides, by showing them the pictures. And essentially, you can train them the exact same way. Show them pictures of slides that are from positive cancerous samples, pictures of slides that are from non-cancerous samples, and they can learn to discriminate those 10 samples. And give them another 10 samples, they can learn to discriminate those. Give them another 10 samples to eventually you get to a point in which you can give them a new set of 10 samples, and they can immediately categorize them on the first trial. And then that you can say that they have generalized that kind of concept. So I don't have an answer of what is the number, but I do have an answer of how will you know if your dog has gotten to that number? Hopefully that's somewhat helpful.
Yeah, no, it is, absolutely. And I probably shouldn't have brought up koala because it's sort of unique in, and I'm no koala expert, so I'll probably get told off, but koala's got a very limited diet, you know, so actually the teaching it to generalize, you know, between different animals, different areas and so on will be arguably a lot easier than a carnivorous, you know, mammal that, you know, could be found on the coastal ranges where it would have a high crustacean diet, you know, versus inland where it would have, you know, a much more kind of small rodent, you know, based diet. And I presume that the scat from those different things would, you know, smell and be chemically remarkably different.
Right.
So much harder to generalize. Yeah, that's a whole kind of rabbit hole, but it does lead me to the main point about, I mean, in the conservation dog world versus a lot of other detection disciplines, finding suitable samples, you know, is one of the key challenges. You know, we can find all the environmental variables and we can train in all of those different conditions, but actually finding samples, and this is why scat is used so much, yeah, you know, because you can collect it, you can store it, yeah, you know, it'll degrade over time, but you can go and find some more, yeah, you know, and get out there and so on. Is there a way that you use within your lab to actually capture scents from, yeah, and train on scents, you know, that may be hard. So I'm thinking live animal scents. One example, I mean, over here in Australia, we've got a lot of snakes, a lot of danger noodles, as we call them. So obviously, if I'm training my dogs to avoid the snakes, I want to be able to sort of, you know, show them a snake, tell them not to. I also don't want to necessarily put either creature next to each other for their mutual well-being.
Right.
So how could I develop, and there aren't a lot of pseudo scents, obviously, in this world. I mean, is there a method that I could employ to actually capture that snake scent, yeah, as an olfactory aid for the dog?
Yeah, so that's a whole separate great question. The idea of training aids and going down that direction of what's good, what's bad, is its own can of worms. So we haven't had to do any live samples. We have done some things from explosive mixtures that I have a chemist collaborator here, Paola, who who gives us the GCMS results of the different kinds of things that we do. And we essentially did a study with one of her master's students where I have an olfactometer. And essentially, the concept is basically simple. You put whatever your substance is in some container, and then essentially you blow air into the container, which then displaces air that's collected into that container and pass it along a Teflon tube, or you could do stainless steel or something, something that's not going to sort of retain odor. And then in our olfactometer setup, we just put that output of the airline right up to where the dog can then sniff it. So then they are separated from whatever that target material is, and they are getting a direct sample of the odor that's coming off of the headspace of whatever that sample is. So that's basically how we do all of the training for us in kind of an indirect way. But to sort of bring that to another step is that there was how the student was looking at is, well, could we have different odors, especially when it comes to mixtures that might be potentially dangerous in sort of an explosives world, activate the olfactometer to present the headspace of those different odors, and then essentially join them together, and then present that to something that we can collect, and then present that to the dog. So the device that seemed to be a really good collector was cotton gauze. So essentially, we just blew the air through a system that contained the target material, collected it with cotton gauze. Lauren DeGrief, she's got a paper out that sort of describes a lot of what she was done with pure chemicals using essentially plastic bags. I forget exactly what the acronym is for it, but it's a polyethylene bag. So you can order the polyethylene bags off of Amazon. And essentially, we then put the cotton that has collected the odor that has been passed through into the plastic bag to essentially protect it. And then you heat seal it. The plastic bag, the nice thing about polyethylene is you can kind of think of it as like a crosshatch pattern of the plastic polymer. And that means that there's little gaps. There's little gaps in it. And those little gaps allow the odor to dissipate. And essentially what it provides is a control. So the odor can't just go gone, but it's providing it at a continuous rate as it's crossing that sort of plastic barrier. And then essentially what you have is a sample that has, you've blown the odor across it for a long period of time, heat sealed it in a plastic bag, and then that plastic bag is slowly dissipating that odor. You, of course, need controls of clean cotton and also heat sealed plastic bags, but that might work for a lot of these scenarios, perhaps even if you, you know, have a lot of times you don't have access to the animal, but you know, might have access to the animal bedding. You might have access to something else that you could have control versus positive that might be either swabbed with cotton or passed the air across and collected the air, heat seal it in a bag that then creates something. Again, it depends on what kind of volatiles are available. I don't know how much of this would be effective, but if I were to create something in that area, that would sort of be the directions of things that we would be looking at. That's based off of some of the things that we had done with the explosives.
Yeah, well, that's very comforting because what I've been trialing so far, and this is off the back of advice that Michelle Morn at PsyK9 gave me, is that we're using the Ducal gauze, the cotton gauze, putting it in the container with a captive snake, you know, for a period of weeks, and then we're bringing that out. We're storing it in one of Michelle and Jenna's TAD devices. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and then using that. So yeah. Hopefully, if you and she agree, then it's good enough for me.
Yeah, the TAD principle is going to be quite similar to the plastic bag principle, actually. It's essentially you have something that's allowing a controlled dissipation of the odor across a membrane, just glass jar versus plastic. So in that sense, it's quite similar in terms of principle. But yeah, there's no real great answer, but using a similar kinds of material, as what you want the dog to find is going to be your benefit. a lot of times we try and simplify it to, it's just this one or two chemicals that the dog finds. But in reality, a lot of times it's going to be some complex mixture. And there are a lot of weird things that happen with odor mixtures. So I get cautious to start divvying it out and saying only these three compounds are important. It very well could be, but a lot of times it'd be those three compounds are most important when also mixed with compounds X, Y, Z. You know, like it gets hard to start pulling things out. And in the same sense that amyl acetate, which is a lot of times used as an artificial banana flavoring, if you've ever had sort of the artificial banana flavor smoothies, you're not confused by the fact that they didn't put a banana in it. You know,
there's no banana there.
No, it's very easy to tell, right? It's very simple. It's very different. And while the amyl acetate might be the most important odor within that, if you were someone who's never had it before and nobody told you it was banana, I bet you there would be people who were to drink that and say, this is interesting. I don't know what this is. You may not spontaneously say, this is banana. Not because it doesn't smell like, or it can be, you know, conceived as banana. It's just because when you remove all of those other chemicals that are a part of the normal banana flavor, it's just not the same. So, but doing whatever you can to sort of try and transport as many of those volatiles would be important.
Yeah, absolutely. That's very helpful. Thank you. So I wanted to ask you now about residual odor. So residual is often used as an explanation for a possible false indication. Mm-hmm. But when you're looking for proof of presence, absence of a cryptic endangered species, you know, and your dog indicates where something may have peed, you know, for example, how can we reliably assess the probability of it being an accurate indication on residual versus it being a false indication?
Yeah, that is a great question. So from a scientific perspective, you know, you can easily run down yourself in a pathway where you feel like you've got all of these finds of just residual odor, or it's very easy, you know, in the same way that taking certain kinds of vitamins might have solved or cured some kinds of things, except for the times that it doesn't, right? And then you just kind of ignore all the times that it doesn't, right? Your dog might be fantastic for all the times that it alerts correctly, you know, except for all the times that it doesn't alert correctly, you just don't mark or record those because, of course, it was residual odor. And that's definitely a very serious concern. Well, at the same time, there's also a very serious concern that there really was residual odor there. You know, you can't just demark and say that that it wasn't particularly there. And again, you're going to have to go back to the very specifics of what your sort of field situation is. In our experience, in some of the settings that we've had going on, is that if you have an unconfirmed and unknown kind of sort of false alert, or what seems to be a false alert but might be a residual, there's no kind of confirmation. When you start reinforcing those, then the dogs start picking up on that very, very quickly. That essentially that it builds a very easy chain of, I search for 10 minutes and I alert. And then there's a probability that I might get something. And that was one of the things that I was talking about with how sensitive some of the dogs were with the contingencies. They learned some of those contingencies that may as well alert because there's a chance I might get something. And in that situation, that becomes very, very difficult to know. So one of the thoughts that we've had, which we haven't had a chance to look at yet, but is looking at, could we potentially set up a scenario in which it's unclear where is the training and unclear where is the operational setting, but you have, say, like, I know a lot of us don't have this sort of pleasure, but imagine, for example, you were to have this area and you could pre-clear an area with one dog so that essentially you have generally a decent idea of this area is clear. And this area is unlikely to have something. That way, alerts within that area, you could probably give yourself at least increased probability that it's a false and you know not to reinforce those. And then if you're one of the people who are on the side of reinforcing all clear kinds of responses, then you also have some kind of evidence that this potential area is likely to be all clear, and that this might be something that you might want to just reward the search behavior in of itself. So we don't know whether that would work or not, but that's just something that I've been sort of thinking of as a way that might be a way to try and address some of these issues. Because when you're reinforcing in an unknown situation, you know, you do have the chance of getting yourself into trouble. But if you could at least reduce the probability that use one dog as to screen this area, and then use the next dog to screen that area, and you can kind of bounce back and forth and allow, you know, some other system or some other detection system, if it's something, depending on what the conservation is, if there's a gold standard detection technology of, you know, you take two steps, look left, right, take two steps, look left, right, you know, and two people clear a certain area, that may be a little bit annoying, but that might make a perfect training environment for your dog. And then that way, if a false occurs in that, you've already had two people clear it, which has significantly reduced the probability that there really is residual odor there, and that that's probably a false and something that you would not want to alert. So no super good answer there, except that you can try and manage your training by setting up certain areas that you at least have some prior probability to believe one thing or another.
No, I actually think that's a great answer. I mean, a lot of the cases that we see over here in Australia, particularly if we're looking for endangered native species, the reason we're doing that outside of the, you know, the kind of the university, you know, research sphere, is because there's a construction project planned or something like that, and there's a federal condition, you know, that a survey needs to happen for that species, make sure it's not there, you know, before approval to clear and build, you know, happens. So you can imagine, you know, the challenges, you know, if you are to find something, obviously that's a good thing, but it's also, you know, from a government stroke, construction company stroke, everything, you know, space, it causes an awful lot of challenges. So you need to be fucking certain, yeah, right, that's what it is.
Right.
So having having a way of, you know, having a method of saying, right, well, actually, we've got two dogs, you know, they're both, you know, trained on this particular, you know, yeah, on the sign of this particular species. They've run separately. We've GPS marked on the first run. We haven't, you know, necessarily rewarded, you know, and then we come back, run the other dog, you know, and then if we get another indication in the same place, mm-hmm. maybe that's good enough to put the cat amongst the pigeons, you know, with with all the conditions and so on. So no, I think that's an awesome, yeah, that's an awesome idea and a great suggestion for the guys out there working in the field. Before we wrap up, I just want to take you back in time a little bit. So back in 2015, you published a paper entitled Pavlovian Conditioning Enhances Resistance to Disruption of Dogs Performing and Odor Discrimination. So how can conservation detection dog trainers use classical conditioning to strengthen their dog's performance?
Yeah, good question. It's nice to bring me back to 2015 before we knew of COVID, right? So that's actually something that the reason why I did that is coming from a more general sort of theory in behavioral sciences, which we call behavioral momentum theory. And the idea is that you can think of every little reinforcer as sort of like you know, sort of building up a little bit of your bulk, building up a little bit more muscle, building up a little bit more muscle. And essentially, you know, think that you have to, one of these days, you're going to have to run through, I don't know, what is it they do at the sports? There's little sheets that you have to put up and you have to bust through it. And you can think about it, right, as every time you've reinforced, you've built up a little bit more muscle. So that's going to be really easy to bust through whatever kinds of, you know, stuff that stands in your way, whatever you might run into, whatever kind of wall you're going to hit, the more momentum you have, the more likely you're going to bust through that and continue on through that wall, regardless of whatever comes up. And that theory has built up using largely pigeons and rodents, pretty good evidence that actually what's driving that is simply Pavlovian conditioning. It's the connection between the target, in this case, the odor and reward. The more that you build that up, the more that that's been reinforced, the stronger it's going to be that when you push them through some kind of wall, like they haven't found it in a day, or if there's some kind of wall, like you have to reinforce intermittently because you don't know if it's true or not, so you don't reinforce it right away. Or if you, I don't know, have to, if it's harder to find or of some other kind of situation, then the idea is that the more Pavlovian conditioning or classical conditioning that has gone behind that, then the stronger that behavior is going to be. So from a classical conditioning perspective, the nice thing about it is that it's always happening. You may not be thinking about it happening, but say your dog goes on a search, say even just in a room, right? The dog searches in the room, you have your target sample on one of five glass jars. They go up to the glass jar with the target one, they alert, you give a reward, you can click if you want, however it is that you particularly do. Well, that situation you might say is operant conditioning or just regular detection training. But what's happening in that setting is that there is the odor and then the reward. Pavlovian conditioning or classical conditioning is happening right in top of that. You can't eliminate classical conditioning from that situation. So in this case, I sort of brought and distilled everything down to just that classical conditioning scenario, where essentially the odor would be presented and then the dogs would get food. The odor would be presented, the dogs would get food. And we spaced it so that it would get one trial every 5 minutes. And we sort of did this as an intervening kind of training. And that produced, that in of itself produced enhanced resistance to disruption like extinction or these other kinds of walls that we threw at the dog. We put hot dog odor everywhere so that the dogs would be distracted. The dogs that had more of that Pavlovian conditioning saw straight through the hot dog and went straight directly to the target odor. We pre-fed them so that they were not hungry. Turns out that didn't have a difference. The dogs would just roll themselves if they had to down towards the target odor. So that wasn't that much of a disruptor, but the other two were, and the dogs that had more of that Pavlovian conditioning helped. So from a functional perspective, what that suggests is that the more training you do and the more experience your dog gets between odor and reward, the more that your dog is going to be sort of prepared or less likely to get disrupted from situations within the field. Or the other sort of thing is that if classical conditioning is sort of the important part to it, then when you may not be able to set up an entire training search pattern or things like that, you can use very simple classical conditioning, which is odor is presented, 1 Mississippi, 2 Mississippi, 3 Mississippi, 4 Mississippi, food. That in of itself, running a couple of trials of those a day, is still going to end up helping keep that training up such that even when there are disruptors, they're going to kind of push through them a little bit. So it highlights me maintaining that contingency between odor food, whether it's through training or just doing it separately as classical conditioning, can help build up that dog's muscle mass or for that particular odor, so that when they have to do something hard, they're going to sort of bust through and keep going.
Yeah, I think that's great. And I think that's a great lesson there for scientists that may be thinking about training their own dogs or getting dogs from rescues, you know, and training them up, you know, for scientific, you know, conservation detection. Just don't get them out of the training shed too early. You know, make sure you've repped out 10,000, you know, reps of indication on what you know is an accurate indication in a wide variety of contexts over a large search time scales. Yeah, all of those variables, yeah, thrown at it before you take the dog out in the paddock, and then that way you're going to greatly minimize the risk of those, you know, those false indications, yeah, happening.
Yep, and training never stops. You know, the more you build it, the stronger it gets, to the point that, you know, it becomes almost automatic. You know, that it's the easier thing to do is to find the target odor because you just done it so much, and that's, you know, that's what you want to do. So.
Yeah, exactly. Look, Nathan, thank you so much for taking the time to chat. It's been really, really informative and really interesting chatting to you. Like I said at the start, I've been looking forward to this this interview a lot because it means I can just geek out on everything kind of olfactory, you know, for an hour or so. So if people are interested in learning more about your work, how should they contact you? How should they follow the work that your lab's doing?
Yeah, they are welcome to email me. Nathaniel.j.hall@ttu.edu. We have a website, although I'm quite terrible at updating it, to be honest. We also have a Facebook, which I'm also not great updating, except for when publications come out. So we'll occasionally post things there. You can join the other two people who like our Facebook page.
I think I'm already one of them, Mike.
but the Facebook page as well as the website. So I put every publication that comes out of our lab, I put a free PDF there. So I know a lot of you guys are really interested in science. And there's a whole separate, we could have another hour on sort of the crappiness of what scientific publishing machine is. Because we turn a system in which, I either do the research for free or someone else pays for it. I do all of the work. I write everything up, send it to a journal. We don't have to go into this, but send it to a journal who has an editor who's working for free that sends it to reviewers who are working for free, who then reviews it, sends it back to me that I then make edits for free. But then they publish it and then charge you $140 to get access to it. Put it this way, anyone who ever asks me for an article will get that article. There is no paywall between me and the actual text and information. I do the information to getting it out to the public. So it's either already posted on my website. If I'm delayed because I forget about it, just send me an email and I will happily send papers, PDFs, and things like that to you guys. And follow us on Facebook.
Thank you for listening to the Conservation Canine Podcast. If you've enjoyed the show, please like, share, and subscribe wherever you find us.